Well, I was looking for Lisa Stevens. All right, I'll ask our marshal to call the next case for consideration.
This is case number A211465, Heidi K. Whiplinger on behalf of the minor children, petitioner respondent, versus Nicholas John Whiplinger, appellant.
And welcome, Mr. Braun, to the Zoom platform of the Court of Appeals. You are the only one that's arguing today, which means that you only have 15 minutes for presentation of your case. You will not have an additional rebuttal because you're not rebutting any other argument. Please introduce yourself and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of before you commence your argument. And also, you should be able to keep an eye on the time clock. It's on my upper left. I'm not sure where it appears on your end of the screen. And when you're ready, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Thomas Braun, B-R-A-U-N, on behalf of the appellant, Nicholas Whiplinger. We are before the Court of Appeals here this morning on an order for protection that was issued by the court on October 15th. Appellant has a number of objections and concerns with respect to the district court order that are procedural, substantive, and constitutional. Let me first start with the procedural issues that we've identified in the briefing. This matter came on for a hearing before the district court, and there were a number of pretrial matters that were addressed by counsel, including hearsay statements that appellants sought to have stricken from the testimony in the case. The court ordered that the police reports were to be excluded, and then started to inquire about video evidence that was present in the case. The petitioner, Ms. Whiplinger, her counsel indicated that there was video that contained statements of the minor children that were subject to this order for protection. But those video statements were not available for production and for admission into evidence on that day of the evidentiary hearing. Counsel for the appellant objected to the admission of those videos, and the court essentially stated that it was going to move forward with the hearing, despite the fact that the videos were not available to be put into evidence, and wanted to get as much evidence into the record as possible. So, responded.
I think we understand what happened here. I want to get to the ultimate issue, and that is, what is the prejudice to your client when we have the testimony of the investigator that is not on appeal? We have your client's own testimony that he actually did put his hands on one of the boys. I mean, what is the prejudice here in admitting the video?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. The prejudice is that the appellant was required to put on his case before the video was even played or even disclosed to him. So his testimony was essentially required to be submitted to the court without knowing what the full scope of the evidence was in the case. So his own admissions, you know, are in fact, you know, what they are. However, it's the children's testimony that he was unaware of and who was required to testify before knowing what those statements were to help.
But we do have the testimony of the investigator that your client was aware of, where the investigator says that the child said that he was essentially strangled. I mean, he did say he was choked. He said he couldn't breathe. I mean, how is your client prejudiced by the additional evidence of the video when we have the testimony of the investigator that we're accepting for all intents and purposes at this point in time?
Yeah, I think it relates to whether the child essentially was in fear of those actions. And that's part of the problem that we have with the order as well, is that the findings of fact, you know, don't specifically talk about whether there was an intent of fear or an actual fear. That's more of the substantive argument. But not having the critical evidence of the child to help even cross-examine what the social worker investigator said at the time, to not be able to be prepared for that testimony is prejudicial to the appellant.
I mean, so let's put aside the fear issue, okay? Let's talk about the harm, right? Because domestic abuse can be fear or harm. So putting aside the fear, we've got the investigator testifying about this essentially a strangulation, which is physical harm. So again, let's go back to the issue of how is your client prejudiced by the additional evidence of the video?
Well, it really relates to essentially the best evidence. I mean, the officer's testimony is essentially, you know, hearsay testimony from the child. The best evidence is the child's statement in and of itself. So,
okay, the child, I don't mean to interrupt Judge Frisch's question, but where did all of a sudden we get this term strangulation? Because there weren't any allegations that this boy suffered any injury. There was no marks, no anything. I mean, even in the petition, which we don't consider to be evidence, but there was no allegation there was red marks or whatever. And the child in the video says that his throat didn't hurt. So where did the strangulation, where did that term emerge?
Well, I think it was embellishment on the part, you know, of the investigator. And that's part of what's prejudicial about this, is that not having that video to confirm essentially what my client's testimony was, which is that he grabbed him, you know, by his jaw, and that there were no marks, that he didn't observe pain. You know, under those circumstances, again, setting aside the fear issue, we don't believe that that level of evidence, coupled with the fact that a parent has a...
Did the child in the video at any time say he was strangled?
I don't believe so.
I didn't see that. That's why I'm asking, because all of a sudden we have what I heard and viewed on a video, and all of a sudden it's morphed into something that sounds, we know strangulation actually is a statutory violation now. So I just wondered where that came up.
I don't. And I think that it's not consistent with the child's statement, which is why it is prejudicial. The additional concern is the notice issue that the appellant raised at the time of the hearing, that, you know, he comes to the hearing prepared for the order for protection. We know what the evidence is. And all of a sudden we have a video that's been undisclosed. And in order for a hearsay statement of this kind to be admitted, either under the residual exception or by pursuant to statute 260C165, I'm specifically talking about paren 4, there has to be sufficient notice to allow the other side to fully prepare. And that certainly did not occur here. And counsel for appellant raised that issue with the court, and the court essentially instructed that let's, you know, go get the video. We're going to take as much as we can today, and we'll come back and essentially admit the video evidence. That runs contrary to the statutory requirement that the appellant be provided with notice, be provided with the evidence. You know, these are very serious matters, orders for protection, because you see what stems from this order, which is a significant change in custody. And if you view these issues outside of the Domestic Abuse Act and under, you know, 518.18 or the best interest test, the court has to do a significant amount of fact finding in order to make a significant change like this. So appellant here gets to trial, doesn't have all the evidence, is required to put his case on out of order, without perhaps the most significant evidence in the case being disclosed. The appellant believes that is actual prejudice, which would have shaped this case much differently had he been provided notice or had the video been excluded. Because it appears as though, I think from the way the court talks about the findings, is that the video was the crucial evidence which led to the court's determination that ultimately an order for protection should issue in this case. There are a number of other substantive issues.
Mr. Brown, it's my understanding that the hearing was continued to the next day so that your client and his attorney could review the video. Is that right?
I think that was in part the case. I don't think the video was available to be played by the petitioner at the time. They didn't have it in their possession. So, you know, they were prepared to present that testimony. So then the following day, the video gets disclosed and then subsequently played for the court. So I wouldn't characterize that as giving the appellant notice and opportunity to review the video. It wasn't available for the court to view. And at that point, he had put most of his case in.
So are you saying that the first time he viewed the video was when it was played for the court? Is that what you're saying?
I think it was disclosed prior to the hearing, but on the same day as the continued hearing. So that second day of evidence, Your Honor. And, you know, at that point, a number of witnesses had already testified in the case, which is what, again, we believe is prejudicial.
Mr. Braun, you previously indicated that you believe that the district court relied on the contents of the video in reaching its conclusion. It certainly doesn't say that in the order for protection itself, and I'm not seeing that in the transcript. Can you point that out to me?
Yeah, let me try to point that out to you. It's not in our brief, Your Honor. I think near the end of the transcript. Hold on here, if I may.
I mean, the way that I read the district court's ruling, and I don't have it up in front of me on the record, it was pretty summary.
Yeah, it was. And I don't think that there's a direct reference that I can point the court to that's going to say that the court, because of the video, you know, made this ruling. But certainly the court found that the video was important enough, continued it. And then after the viewing of the video, and really, that's the child's statement, right? That came in for substantive purposes. That this was domestic abuse, and I think it's significant enough to have affected the court's, you know, judgment in the case. Finding 5 in Addendum 2, which is the court order, is not very helpful to this court in determining, you know, how or why the court reached its conclusion with respect to domestic abuse. I wish I could offer more insight to that, but it's just really not available. The court made some other findings that the appellant finds particularly problematic, and findings related to what the judge had heard. There's a reference in the transcript that the judge had heard that there was a criminal investigation, and then ordered the appellant to cooperate with that criminal investigation, and that's certainly contrary to his Fifth Amendment rights. I don't understand how that order relates to the finding of domestic abuse. And certainly I have never seen a court order that an individual comply and cooperate with an investigation of a criminal matter. Also somewhat problematic for the appellant, Your Honors, is that the court suspended his parenting time essentially until the investigation was complete. I believe the statute of limitations on a matter of this kind is 3 years. So obviously the order doesn't go that long, but there's a substantial deprivation of his parenting rights while law enforcement may or may not be investigating this matter, as well as social services. So to leave this open-ended resolution and essentially a direction to come back in the family file to correct this domestic abuse no contact order procedurally, we believe is an error. If you go back to just the substantive issue, because this is where I think the court could just reverse on this issue, because, you know, remand may not be particularly helpful given some of the issues that we have raised, is that the actions that the child talks about, you know, being grabbed by the jaw, and the appellant's admissions that he did in fact grab him by the jaw, but that there was no physical harm, that the appellant did not intend fear of the child. And that the child, there's nowhere in the record that the child is essentially felt afraid at that time.
Well, in fact, in the child video, he said he felt safe with that. And that's what I find confusing, is that you're arguing against the video. I think the video is helpful to your client. Well, that's not a question, it's a comment.
Well, fair enough. And you know, that comment with regard to fear certainly is helpful. And I think that's why this is really the main issue for the court, because if you find that the record is insufficient with respect to domestic abuse, you don't have to reach these other issues.
And well, what bothers me, Mr. Braun, is that the police officer, my notes are watching the video, that she is the first one that says, he grabbed you by your throat. And then from that point on, we're talking about the throat. And as I understand it, your client maintained that he did something with his face, which squeezing his face or something like that. So I'm concerned about terminology and how much emphasis it's put on a word. So is my recollection of the video wrong? Is that it?
No, Your Honor, I think you're right about that. And I think that it was the investigator who was talking about the strangulation in the throat. That is not consistent with my client's testimony. I don't believe that's consistent with what the child reported in the video. Yet that's ultimately what the court concluded, was that there was domestic abuse. And I don't see a basis to conclude that there's domestic abuse as a result of fear, because the record is really devoid of any accusations of intended fear or actual fear. So the bodily harm has to be what the court relied on. Again, that's not entirely clear, but there's no bruising. There's no redness. So I think it's insufficient.
Is it your claim that there can't be bodily harm because there's no bruising and no redness and that's it?
No, I think bodily harm is more extensive than that. I think it's, you know, any unwanted touching that causes harm. But I think that even under these accusations, that's not present in this case. And again, the fear component is not present as well. So we think that there is sufficient reason for this court to simply reverse the district court's opinion. Thank you.
Judge Warkey, may I ask?
I was just going to ask if there is any questions. Go ahead, Judge Ryan.
In your briefing, you talk a lot about how the judge did not find the intent element for your client. Did you raise that in district court? I didn't see that in the record.
You know, I don't know that that issue was raised in terms of argument by counsel. I don't recall seeing that either. I think this case has largely been about, you know, bodily harm and whether this was an assault. Fear has never really been an issue, I don't believe.
Any other questions?
Thank you. No.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Braun. The matter is deemed submitted and a decision.